the witness position was because of my interest in computers and experiences in electronic tech and my hobbies. And not the least that my mother's cousin was an important person to get that lab. It always helps, especially in a big institution. I was really amazed when I got the job. The summer was an exciting time, and the internship led off because it was the quintessential secret government laboratory, which would appeal to any kid. To get in, you left a highway on a road marked no trespassing. The glove road leads up to a gate and a chain fence with some sort of U.S. government unauthorized personnel forbidden or something like that sign on. I don't remember the wording. Then I passed a scowling guard and you park your car. The building was huge, but it had many entrances, but only one of which you were authorized to use. The guard scrutinized you when you went in during the building. The guard scrutinizes you and your security badge from the safety of a peephole. And if you qualify, an electrically operated steel door opens to the inner sanctum. And there was a lot of internal security in the building also. I was assigned solo to my own circuit development project. The purpose of the project was the design and prototyping. The design and prototyping of the first really powerful digital computer in the world. It was for nothing less than coordinating the air defense of the United States and Canada. The atmosphere around the place wasn't what I expected. In spite of the secrecy, there was much more camaraderie between the professional workers than I had seen before. Not to mention the genuine Boston deli they had in addition to the cafeteria. I had never experienced that before either. I never went to the cafeteria for lunch because I first tried out the deli. I also enjoyed trips into the town of Boston, except for the roads and traffic. Nice when you get there and get them there. And computer was had this two names: the civilian name of SAGE, standing for Semi-Automatic Ground Environment, which is a very good use of acronym. And the Air Force called it the FSQ-7. It's a strange thing to remember, but I'll never forget that. FSQ-7. The inputs were the plots of all the air defense radars in the U.S. and Canada and all the flight plans of any type filed in the U.S. and Canada. It pinpointed deviant radar plots. Aircraft after vetting for slow speed, low altitude, and so forth. The possible threats, called bogeys, were plotted on one of many individual CRT consoles equipped with light pens. Now, this is fantastic for 1955. Nobody ever thought of a CRT console. Mm-hmm. And a light pen is just a variation of a mouse, really. Instead of using the pen to move a cursor, and using the mouse to move a cursor, you use the pen itself as a cursor. Mm-hmm. And showed a little outlines of airplanes, bogey airplanes, labeled alphabetically with ID number and other notations, speed, direction, arrow, and compass setting. By the arrow, altitude, and additional things that I don't remember. The computer and set of consoles were in a blast-proof concrete building about 150 feet square by 4 stories high. You could literally walk around inside this computer. In fact, I did. It was finished in 1957 and was up and online with 15 replicas of itself in the U.S. in 1958. IBM was a contractor and they built the replicas this fast because they were kept up to date on the prototyping phase. It was built, of course, in 55, it was built using vacuum tubes. Consider that by 1975, 8 years before this computer was taken offline, the big computer was taken offline, all computers were built using third-generation solid-state circuits, which says a lot for the reliability that was built into the FSQ-7. Another thing I learned about avoiding marginal designs and things like that. Everything was not only tested, but all the operating margins were tested. You simulate every kind of conceivable combination of faults and power supplies and see how bad it should get and have it still work. And there were special tools that were designed for long life. It was amazing, especially in retrospect.
Were there some other college students?
Yeah, there were. There was, I can't remember his name, but he was from, in the next lab in those other offices from mine, and he was from Oberlin College.
Was there any formal activity for you as a student, or you were just kind of plugged in?
No, it was a formal activity. I was given a designated project and told to work on it and make reports. And I was treated, except for salary, as a real engineer. And I can tell you exactly what I was working on. The computer was so huge that the propagation time for signals going from one part of the computer to another, to say the processor floor to the memory floor or something like that, were so long that they would use coaxial cable to connect them up. And I designed a driver that was used for every one of these coaxial cables. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It took a went from logic level to level that would drive a coax cable 15 volts for a 92-93 ohm cable, mm-hmm. which is a lot of capacity to charge and discharge. The cable is 200 feet long, like some of them are.
This was your first extended time away from home.
That's right. Yeah, I'd spent maybe one month working at the ranch once, but that was with relatives, and this was on my own. It was quite it was something. Met girls without parental supervision, which was, I say about that anyway, but that. that was another big point, a big positive point of the place. And so the manager of the place was Jay Forrester, and he went from modeling air defense environment to modeling large corporations to modeling economies in general. Now, Lincoln Labby has spoken out with reverence, and case I forget to mention it later, he was the only one in management there that visited me in the hospital. And I've met him several times since, three or four times since, once I've been accepting the award for him when he was out of the country. That was a real privilege.
Where was that?
Huh? Where was that? I didn't even have to go for it. It was amazingly enough, it was being held at the local university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When was that? Well, don't worry now.
I'm working on it. Early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't remember it was late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. On the 11th of August, 1955, during the last big cholera epidemic, I woke with a stiff neck, didn't think much of it, went to work. After I swam a lot when I was working there at a suburban lake that had a lot of houses around it, but it was designated a public swimming place, at least for residents in that county. And since I was living in that county, when I was permanent resident, I was good enough. Anyway, I went and I swam in that lake, and which I'd often enjoyed swimming in. Learned how to swim underwater for considerable distances, which was fun. The water was real clear. And I felt better from the exercise, but I had a headache and a sore back the next day, and the next day was a Friday. After work, I swam again and felt better. The next day was Saturday, and I didn't feel any better after swimming. Sunday, I stayed in bed. On Monday, I got up and just managed to drive the 20 miles to work. My superior saw me when I got to my office and sent me to the dispensary, which had a full-time medical doctor and nurse. As I said, this was a big place. And the tentative diagnosis was poliomyelitis, and he drove me to a medical laboratory. Don't drive yourself in this condition, he said. For a definitive and unfortunately positive test. He then drove me to the emergency entrance of the Massachusetts General Hospital, which is composed of several different buildings with different names like White and I can't remember the name of the famous architect from Boston, one of them being Mexican.
Stanford White.
Huh? No, he's an earlier. He's early 1800s, and not late 1800s. You know, it's not. Oh, I don't know. He designed a lot of the early buildings in Boston. And he drove me to the emergency entrance and told me I should crawl home and wave goodbye. There's a big crowd around the entrance, people with broken arms, bad clothes, bleeding cuts, and so forth. Some guy with a bad knife cut on his face blustered up to me and said, "You don't look so bad, what are you doing here?" And I told him. He jumped back, and the crowd moved before me, and I had access to the payphone. Better than leprosy. I called my parents, and for some reason didn't expect them to come, probably because I was confused. A man in a white uniform and a clipboard was going around listing ailments for triage. I talked to him and he told me to come inside right away. That was the last time I walked. Two orderlies with face masks tossed me onto a gurney and pulled me to an isolation room on the 8th floor. Severe paralysis developed in a few days. And my parents came in to visit. It was about a day and a half after I phoned them. And they dropped everything. Some friends from work visited, waited me as well as my mother's cousin. Then I became sick enough to be moved to the 10th floor of their White building, which was reserved entirely for critical polio patients. Condition was soon downgraded to danger, and we had to pay, and since everybody in the same condition was segregated together, I had the experience of seeing patients like me die around me, and that was scary. And I spent 3 days in there, and I had a lot of weird, vivid, detailed storytelling hallucinations, all of which I remember quite clearly. And then got better, progressing up to critical and then back up further to fair. At this time I met a wonderful nurse, and we were very attracted to each other, and practically had a love affair, and And then after I was evacuated, which was by National Guard medical medevac, National Guard medevac plane back to Lincoln on October 22nd, and a fair didn't survive long after that. After I was gone. She moved closer to Lincoln, but it was a half step. It was still a long ways to Lincoln. In addition to paralysis, my legs couldn't be moved because of muscle contractions. The treatment for this was radical leg stretching by a physical therapist. This was carried out every weekday morning and to such an extreme that I would lose consciousness from the pain and wake up in a chill in some other room. This went on for 1.5 years. The only way I remained sane was to withdraw mentally from my physical condition. This worked, but it desocialized me again. I was discharged from the hospital in June 1958. So while still in the hospital, I restarted part-time at UNL. University of Nebraska at that time was not at all accessible, but I found enough friends to push and carry my wheelchair about. I also had help from the State Department of Welfare, help from the State Department of Rehabilitation. Most photo survivors convert to a Class A or Type A personality, and myself included. Pretty exaggerated type A. I would study all day from the time I woke up to 11 p.m. at night. My grades changed to A+ every semester at one, and that was an A for the following 6 semesters that I was in school. In September 1958, I was full-time, doing a full-time course load in chemistry and electrical engineering. My most influential teacher was Dr. Donald Nelson in electrical engineering and Professor Cecil Vanderzee in physical chemistry. Dr. Vanderzee opened up a whole new world for me. I learned more in physical chemistry about what happens and why things happen in any other 10 courses I ever took. A wonderful course. Graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering in 59. Now I'll go back to 19, I have to go back to 1957 to explain why I didn't go on for the PhD.
You were living at home once.
Yes, I'll get to that. Disco was a company that started as a part-time business in late 1957 to repair and make scientific instruments. This was just before I started back in school. This was a suggestion of Dr. Robert Feeney, then chairman of the UNL Biochem Department. While I was a student and still recovering from polio, he introduced me to my future business partner, Jacob Schaefer. Jacob was a toolmaker at the Elgin Watch Company in Lincoln. I was anxious to work in school, which, as I mentioned before, I was receiving welfare, but wanted to be independent. I started with Jake repairing microscopes and myself repairing about everything else on weekends when I was furloughed from the hospital. Jake worked in his basement and I worked in my father's garage. After a few months of repair work, we started getting requests for making custom one-of-a-kind pieces of scientific apparatus. Pretty soon, we started getting jobs that required machine work, but by then we had enough money in the kitty to buy our first machine to a little South Bend engine lathe for Jake's basement. By the way, Esco still has this lathe in Houston. It's an engineering model shop until 97. Why don't we break for lunch?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see, we got some tea. And this is one I'm going to say something about him first. No, let's see, I think I mentioned somewhere. He was born in 1938. And brother problems with the big brother, and I had a big brother problems with the little brother. And he was also had scientific interests, and he was more interested in holding the shop than I was. And in high school, by the time he was in junior high, he was an accomplished woodworker with the tools he had, a fair machinist. We didn't have much tools at home for machinery. I remember once in grade school, he built a Bunsen spectroscope from scratch. Edmund Scientific Prison. He made the arms and the slits and the table for the prison and stuff like that. Took it to his science fair and got nothing on it because nobody believed that he made it himself. They thought it was purchased. They were really bummed about that. You and I have always been interested in guns. Made mostly because of at least until the 20th century, any cultures, most cultures' developments in metallurgy and machinery and kinematics and so forth were reflected in the quality and maturity of the design of their guns. Mm-hmm. Building a handgun or a rifle up until 1900, the quality of design and construction determined even from a gross standpoint about how good and how safe the weapon was. And so small arms were always on the leading edge of technology for many, for thousands, not a thousand years, but for 500 years. And I think John looked at it a little differently. He was he's more of a hunter and shooter than I am, he is interested in them because they're devices that he can build and make a quality product. He's made guns, and he's restored antique guns in horrible condition into good shooters, and he's got a collection that's guns have appreciated tremendously, and he's got a collection where he started in the late 50s, in the early 60s, he's got a collection that's worth many times that he put into it. I've got a much smaller collection, and I didn't buy it with an idea of investment. I bought it because of historical value. in the 70s, I sold a lot of my historical guns off because they were afraid they'd get confiscated anyway. That was a mistake. But the, let's see. He's developed from the, at least, no, we'll get back to what he did. We went into, went to university. He didn't want to take engineering because he didn't want to, have any professors that had me. He had trouble with that before, living in my shadow, and so he took geology. And he got a master's in geology and worked as a geophysicist for Pan American Oil Company. He was stationed in Casper, Wyoming. Went out to visit him once in his living room. It was a nasty apartment. And a bug dropped off the ceiling on the back of my hand and bit me, and then jumped off the table and disappeared into a crack. My hand swelled up. Nice room, nice place. Casper, I remember, was another tough town. And he was dating and then living with an Indian girl who was, we met once in an emergency room when he hurt himself. She was a nurse. And then he was transferred to Louisiana. He was on a, what they call a size boat. And it'd be this flotilla of boats running, paddling slowly across the Gulf, keeping track of their position. Every so often, the boat in the middle, called the powder boat, would let off a bomb, an underwater bomb in the water. And everything jiggle and shake, and then record all the stuff in the seismographs and bring it back for processing. And they have various secret processes. There are known processes and secret processes for determining the underground locations and species of underground strata from these reflections. And wouldn't happen in this flotilla, but the one other flotilla, the powder boat blew up. And all everybody saw was a tremendous orange blast, and their size boats rocked back and forth, almost swamped, and they never found a trace of the powder boat. And he said he would have quit if they put him on the powder boat. And when he was there, he went over there and started using the Cajun girl. You know, he's much on the local color, I guess. And no, I didn't mean that as a double entendre, forgive me. I don't think that way. But they, much on the
local flavor.
Atmosphere. I mean, he would absorb atmospheres. And when we get back to, get to the date, I think it was 64, I offered him a job as in charge of sales here, because up to that time I was in charge of management, design engineering, sales, accounting, which means I kept putting the stuff in the box and sending it off. And that was getting too much for me to handle. And so he came here for that, and it was there many years. He took early retirement a few years ago. He's got a tremendous hobby. He's got a complete machine shop in his basement, and he has that for a number of years. You know, the lathe, the milling, the machine, or well, the lathe was a milling machine. You can almost build about, you can build almost anything out of metal. And he's got all the ancillary stuff like drill press and so on. Too, he's got a whole stuff. I remember once he was working repairing his lathe, and the thing tipped over and fell on him. He didn't hurt him, but he was trapped.
His wife was home, mother was home
for a while before he got out from under that thing. That was a pretty scary situation. And he's doing full time making and making things and playing with machinery and stuff. And anybody that got associated with ESCO to start like that would be in a position to do that. He's a mobile.